Welcome to the Fairest Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love.
On this podcast, I had the privilege of speaking with Tracy Windsor, co-founder and parent program director of Be Not Afraid, a ministry dedicated to accompanying parents facing a prenatal diagnosis. Tracy discusses how Be Not Afraid supports parents, demonstrates the dignity of all human life, and gives encouragement to those who may be struggling with fears associated with a diagnosis. Okay, Tracy, thank you so much for joining our show.
My privilege.
We're very excited to have you on and to talk about this incredible organization that you have co-founded and are the director of. I would love to hear about Be Not Afraid and how it started and kind of just how it's grown since it first started.
Yeah, so my co-founder and I, probably, I guess it's been like 16 years now, we're doing parish-based perinatal loss ministry. And we had a year where two families experienced a prenatal diagnosis and did not get what they needed in terms of support. Interestingly, my co-founder had also carried to term with a prenatal diagnosis, but we didn't think about service development around her initially. At the point that we had the two families, we thought, you know, we need to go find somebody in the community, a Catholic doctor or a hospital. Somebody should be addressing this. And we spent at least a year, maybe longer, trying to find that other person or other organization. And then at some point we realized maybe God was asking us not to find that other organization, but to be that organization. And so we initiated our service at about 14 years ago. To be honest, we didn't think we had a prayer. We thought that we would have a hard time generating referrals from the medical community. And particularly because we were Catholic and we had managed to organize what was called a perinatal hospice roundtable that involved the medical community, where we were outed pretty aggressively as Catholic women. We were asked what the church's position was on abortion. That was the first question at the roundtable. So we just thought, we're never going to get a referral. There's no way this will work, but we'll just try it for a year. And if it doesn't work, then God will just let us go. And it worked. And I think what we really found was that our desire to be at birth was important, and that our births looked really different, even if it meant the death of the baby, than say the abortion at the hospital looked. And as a result, I had a nurse say to me, I didn't realize you all were a service. I just thought this mom had the best friends in the world. And so I thought, well, this is how it's gonna work. We're providing something to them that doesn't exist, and they're willing. It's really good news for Catholics and for pro-lifers. The medical community is willing to refer if it's something viable that they can't provide to parents. And so over probably the next 12 years, we got bigger and bigger, and we came up with a more formal approach to service that was research-based and trauma-informed and rooted in Catholic ethics. And then in the last couple of years, we determined that there were just too many families. We were serving parents nationally, and we needed to have more workers in the vineyard. And so we initiated a training program with the funding of Knights of Columbus to develop our training. And we have now trained a number of organizations. So there's a national network that is using the BNA model of care that people can access via the BNA website, although we're not serving parents directly any longer. We're completely focused on training.
Wow, excellent. Can you do us a favor and just kind of explain those two terms that you've just for our audience, for the prenatal diagnosis, so the difference between that and then the prenatal hospice? Can you explain those terms and just clarify? So
in our model of care, we are serving parents whether they actually have a diagnosis. So they've done some testing. A lot of times parents are consenting to testing without full informed consent. And then they get some peculiar screening result. Oftentimes for Catholic women, there's a test called NIP testing, non-invasive prenatal testing. It's a screening result. It may be represented as more significant than a screening result in an effort to get a mom to do an amnio. Mom doesn't do amnio. So sometimes it is a diagnosis, which would be that there's an anatomical issue that's discovered on ultrasound or fetal MRI or fetal echo. Sometimes it's a genetic condition, Down syndrome, which is trisomy 21 or trisomy 18 or trisomy 13. And we serve parents whether they have the actual diagnosis or not, simply because we have research now that indicates that being told that something is atypical about your baby is experienced by most parents as a traumatic event. So whether you know for certain there's an issue or whether you're planning for a birth with uncertainty, we feel like our trauma-informed care is helpful.
Great.
And perinatal hospice, that was the second question,
yeah,
sorry. Yeah, thanks. Perinatal hospice was initiated as a concept about 20 years ago. It was the first time that anybody really looked at, you know, what, how do we serve parents that don't terminate? What do we do for them? And it was founded by Dr. Byron Calhoun, who's a wonderful pro-life maternal fetal medicine specialist. And he found that parents who were offered a service that would support them at birth were much more likely to carry to term. So in his data, I think this goes back probably 20 years, 80% of parents would abort with a prenatal diagnosis, but 80% would carry to term if offered this service. Mm. Obviously with the word hospice, the service was very focused on the idea that we could tell what babies would die and what babies would live. The research, the medical research has changed over the last 20 years around a number of the diagnoses that were considered to be lethal then. So perinatal hospice now, because it involves limiting care before birth, is not consistent with Catholic ethics on this issue and has to be concerning for parents. So we provide a service that plans both for the possibility that we might lose a baby if this is a really serious diagnosis, but more importantly, that provides for the examination of the living child at birth. So that a final determination can be made regarding the diagnoses that have been identified prenatally.
Okay, excellent.
Does that help?
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
And so when you mentioned like that there are obviously the Catholic families that you serve, but are there other, they're non-religious probably as well, who just
yeah, believe? Yeah, we serve a lot of families that aren't, probably the majority of our families aren't Catholic. Mm. And the interesting thing is that, you know, when we talk about evaluating the living child with a prenatal diagnosis or a suspected diagnosis at birth, that's called stabilization and evaluation. And most parents, even not Catholic parents, want that option to confirm whatever has been seen and then to maybe have some time with baby. So a lot of our parents, we have a document at our website that's a Catholic ethics document that we worked on with the NCDC, direction for parents, guidance for parents. And a lot of our not Catholic parents will actually use that. Let me just to give you an example. You could have an ultrasound provided by a maternal fetal medicine specialist that determines there's a heart defect. That ultrasound might be provided at 12 weeks. Now, you would be offered, in most cases, the option of abortion at that point. That doesn't take into consideration the fact that you haven't spoken to a doctor who treats living children with heart defects. That would be a pediatric cardiologist. And the best way to see a fetal heart is called a fetal echocardiogram, which they won't provide to you until you're about maybe 17 weeks pregnant because they feel like the heart is too small to see. Mm. Even then, you might have that test, have that consult with a pediatric cardiologist, and be offered abortion again. Mm. So the reality is you can end baby's life during the pregnancy based on that. But if you carry your baby to term, no pediatric cardiologist will touch your baby based on that fetal echocardiogram. They'll repeat the echocardiogram on the living child because there's always the potential for there to be a difference. So this is where the idea of stabilization and evaluation becomes really important and is often something parents aren't aware of. Mm-hmm. You think if I could be offered the opportunity to end this baby's life, certainly this is predictive enough that they would act on this for treatment. They don't.
Mm. And you know, the parents probably, they trust their medical professions and they don't ask questions and they just hope that that's the challenge. What right. are some of the fears and challenges that parents face once they have this prenatal diagnosis?
Yeah, I think immediately it's really important, as I talked about the experience of a traumatic event, it's like 88% of mothers and 83% of fathers. And that does something in particular that should be concerning for us in the Catholic community because we do have such informed teaching regarding ethics and end of life, beginning of life and end of life. It makes, number one, parents very susceptible to directive counseling, which is often what parents get, sadly, the idea that abortion is their best option or maybe their only option. And it also, you know, we talk about trauma as being the loss of connection. It's a loss of connection in the moment. You know, if you think about a traumatic experience as making you feel like you're watching the situation as a movie, it can also mean a loss of connection to like your general moral beliefs. It's hard to, I mean, parents should have time to think about and to consult and to discern what they want to do, but very frequently they get directive counseling. They're very unsteady with their own connection to their own moral beliefs, and they're making the decision ultimately that can cause moral injury. So the issue of trauma, I think, is big at diagnosis. Then again, there's oftentimes with the babies with conditions that are still routinely presented as lethal, there's a kind of a desire to manage those babies towards a different death, which would be maybe comfort care at birth. So it's hard for parents to get the information they need and to know how best to advocate for a more Catholic approach to these diagnoses, but what is also a more parent-centered approach, because most parents want to confirm those diagnoses if they understand that that's a possibility.
And how does Be Not Afraid help in those situations? I know you'd mentioned the doctor saying, wow, I didn't realize these, you know, these look, I thought they were just very close friends in the midst of birth and all that. How does that look in regards to these challenges?
So a couple things, because we weren't medical providers, we're very focused on research. And that has been very helpful to us because as the research was changing over the last 10 to 20 years, we were tracking that. We also were providing trauma-informed care, which focuses on this idea that if connection, if loss of connection is what a traumatic event is, then having a connection, having a person who steps into your crisis and is working with you is actually an antidote to trauma. So we're very focused on developing the personal relationship with the parents so that our care can be parent-centered and baby-centered. A lot of times, again, there's the idea that if you've seen one baby with trisomy 13, you've seen every baby with trisomy 13, and the babies can be really different. So we step in with a lot of commitment of time. We're collaborating with parents. We're making certain that they have the most recent research. We're making certain they have informed consent. We're welcoming baby, realistically, but definitely welcoming baby, which is often something that is lost to them. When abortion is offered, everybody else is kind of distancing themselves from baby. And then we're really working on helping them anticipate the path ahead, like where the next decision points are, what resources might be helpful in connecting them to those resources. And then again, trauma is like the loss of safety. So we really work on giving them opportunities to feel capable, something called agency. So we say to them, you know, we trust you 100%. You've made the most selfless decision you could make to carry this baby to term. You need the information to make the best decision for yourself and baby. So we really focus on giving them opportunities to succeed in small ways so that when they get to birth, they can advocate for the care they need or the care they want for their baby.
Beautiful. Do you have any anecdotal stories or any stories of how Being Not Afraid has kind of changed, you know, the not perception, but just more of like how you've not influenced, you know, just how you've taken care of this certain
what the engagement
that,
I think we see it pretty quickly. So our first contact with parents is within about 24 to 48 hours of them reaching out to us. We really try to stick to that 24-hour mark. And the first thing we try to do is schedule a conversation, and we get on the phone with them and they say, tell us what's happening. And that phone call might be an hour and a half, but we're available for that. We never say, oh, listen, I need to wrap this up, right? So we have the time that the medical community doesn't have. And parents will often tell you they're this terrible, devastating, traumatic diagnosis story that was completely unexpected because maybe they didn't realize that NIPT testing was doing anything other than figuring out if they were having a boy or a girl. Most people don't think that they're going to be engaged in obstetric care and have somebody suggest abortion. Sometimes there's tears as they're telling us the story. And then we spend some time taking notes, listening. If there were things that were not accurately presented to them after they finish their story, we'll go back and double back to those things. Always acknowledging baby. If I haven't heard baby's name at the end of the story, I'll say, tell me what baby's name is. And so at the end of the hour and a half or an hour, when we say, and this is an example of giving parents agency, we say there's a lot of decisions that you can't make around a prenatal diagnosis, but you get to decide if we're around or not. So I'm going to tell you what we provide, and then you make a decision. You can certainly reach back out to us. I would say in 99% of cases, parents say, no, I want this. I need this. And they'll say at the end of the phone call, I feel better. This is the best I felt. When really we haven't changed the situation. We've just been available to focus on them, and we're promising them the commitment of time to help them navigate the path ahead. Very few parents, maybe we've served 300 babies ourselves. I think maybe we had two parents and 300 that declined service after that conversation. So it's immediate. And then I think really what we've seen as we've focused on stabilization and evaluation is a lot of babies survived to discharge who parents were told did not have a prayer of living. And they're complicated babies. Sometimes they go home with a trach and they're on a home vent. Sometimes they need support feeding. They're often disabled, severely or significantly disabled, but they're the immortal soul that was trusted to this family, right? And parents love them. And parents, any parent is sacrificing for their child. So it's really the parent's decision what amount of sacrifice they're willing to provide. And most parents are willing to go pretty far for the baby that God sent to them.
Yeah, that's probably so powerful to see too. And
it is
inspiring. You had mentioned kind of how the medical community doesn't have time for these parents in that sense. I mean, I'm sure there are people that do, but just in thinking of that, and then also in thinking of kind of what these parents have to face with not being in the medical field or not knowing questions to ask, how do you support them in advocating for their child after the decision to say, we're going to carry this baby to full term and we're going to love them? And, you know, how would you support them in all the questions that they receive or all the statements that they receive?
Yeah. So the first thing we do is we try to address that trauma with connection. And we also address grief. Anybody that has a prenatal diagnosis has kind of lost the pregnancy that they thought they were going to have. And oftentimes, if they were anticipating a lot about baby, if it's a first baby, they've lost the baby too. It doesn't mean the baby's not going to live, but it means it's a different baby. So we focus on those two things. And then, as I said, we really concentrate on what misinformation do they already have? Do they think that the NIP test is diagnostic when it isn't? Are they aware of all the consequences that might follow an amniocentesis if they're considering that? I would say one of the biggest things is parents don't realize that they've been offered abortion by doctors who never treat living children. They get to a maternal fetal medicine specialist or a perinatologist, and they just presume that person has the expertise necessary to provide a prognosis to them when that's not at all the case. And your pediatric providers, the pediatric cardiologists and the pediatric neurosurgeons and neurologists will tell you that. Certainly neonatologists will as well. And then it's a matter, you know, because we need to support them in having better communications with their medical providers. We don't want them to go in fighting because they're always going to be behind the eight ball in terms of their understanding of the medical aspects. Mm-hmm. So we focus on making certain they have research, making certain if they're Catholic, they understand the Catholic expectations. That's why we have the document at our website, so they have something to walk in. And then we even work with them on like, what's an effective way to have a good consult? If you know that stabilization and evaluation is something you're gonna have to advocate for, and it's not something that everyone is inclined to do in your particular hospital, how do you walk in there and be the best advocate for yourself? And that's about being effective, being able to talk about all outcomes calmly, not bursting into tears, thanking people, being respectful of the providers in front of you. And we found our parents have a lot of success at that. So in surveys, 96% of our parents said we improved their communication with their medical providers. And I think that's our primary goal in helping them with advocacy, because they need to, because we're not medical and we can't just refer them to a doctor that makes everything perfect. In most cases, they need to be able to bring those providers along with them.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. Yeah. What would you say, how would you, in addition to your support within direct communication with the parents and then how they communicate with the medical field. How would you recommend parents go about creating like that network outside of their, you know, outside of you and outside of the medical environment to kind of support them as they go through this journey?
Yeah, I think that trauma-informed care is really important. Even if parents feel like they're in a pretty good spot, a lot of times parents will call us and they'll say, I have a pro-life doctor, but by the end of that hour conversation, hour and a half, they're kind of already realizing that there's information they weren't given, maybe. So I do think it's really important. So our service is called parent care coordination. It's like case management support. And our weekly contact is really important. There are things that we tell parents to do that are helpful probably for anyone. We suggest that they think of a way or they utilize a way that they can bring friends and family along their usual community. And we suggest having like a caring bridge. A lot of times parents will say, well, I have a Facebook page, but the reality is most of us on our Facebook pages have people that we don't want to bring along on a major crisis in our life, right? And hitting the reset and having some online page, whether some parents already have a blog, they can do it, but you can name it in baby's name before baby comes, which can be very helpful in terms of asserting baby's dignity, even to the people who love you, who get really focused on the diagnosis or the suspected diagnosis once it's made. So I think having ways to bring your usual friends and family along. And when you're writing to everybody, let's say you have a sister-in-law who's doing a terrible job of this. You don't have to say that to her, but you can tell her how somebody else is doing a wonderful job. And maybe she'll pick up on that. Likewise, if you have kids, you really need your family and friends to know what the children understand and what the messaging is that's being used for the children so that they don't say something that you don't want them to. You also get to tell people what they need to pray for, because a lot of times people are praying for things that are off the mark. So there's that. I think it's also really important for couples to realize that, you know, sometimes we see a difference in how moms and dads grieve and how moms and dads handle crisis. And so for many of our moms, you know, they're deeply entrenched in all the testing and all the appointments. And dad might be busy working. If he doesn't exactly need to be busy working, it might be that working's just a better place for him to be because the details and the uncertainty are kind of burdensome. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for parents to understand that their individual experiences might look kind of different, and that's pretty normal. It doesn't mean that somebody doesn't care or that somebody is hysterical. It's just different. I think too, a lot of times parents are reluctant, Catholic or not, to involve their clergy. Mm-hmm. And I think that we often find it's very possible to have a deacon or a priest, if we ask for that, meet with families, if they understand the situation, sometimes they'll anoint mom and consider that an anointing for the baby. Mm-hmm. A pregnancy blessing that's sensitive to the situation could be very important. And a clergy visit in the hospital, especially for us as Catholic women, because, you know, we're looking for Christ in these terrible moments of crisis, and having that presence can be really helpful. So those would be, I think, the three things. Mm-hmm. I would suggest referral to a service that's trauma-informed, which is ours, and then the other three things.
Yeah, that's excellent. And so you were talking about the services, the trauma-informed. How have you seen the people that you serve, like, their stories, you know, from fear, you know, uncertainty? How have you seen those change throughout the course of your serving them and throughout the course of their pregnancies to be more hopeful and to be more peaceful?
Yeah, I think that when parents have the tools they need to feel like they can regain their safety or their footing, that this terrible thing has happened, and the immediate experience of it felt overwhelming, like they just didn't know what to do and had no understanding of what was happening. So I think the more that they have opportunities, which is really our job, to have conversations and to have successes. So a lot of times we'll have parents that are very concerned about a consult. We've talked about what their talking points will be. And I might even say to a mom who I know she's really anxious, I might say, you know what, just write this down and tell them, you know, you walk in, you say, thank you so much for meeting with us. This diagnosis has been very difficult for us. And we had some things we wanted to say. I'm going to just quick read them. And moms will be like, I can do that. Yeah, you can do that. The mother will call us back and be like, I did what you said. And it was so amazing. They all thanked me for all the detail we had. And they appreciated the birth plan that I walked in and that I was so well-educated. And so, I mean, you know, part of this is that getting parents ready to meet the best parts of the medical providers in front of them. And ultimately, we find most medical providers will be really flexible and mindful. One of the things that we tell parents to say in those consults is, you know, I recognize that you may not agree with what we have decided we want for this baby, but the truth is, this is the only baby we're going to have this year. And you're going to have 200 babies this year, or maybe more. And when this is all said and done, we have to live the rest of our lives with whatever the end of this story was. And you won't even remember this baby's name. And a lot of doctors will suddenly say, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way. So a lot of times it's just about helping parents find some success. We certainly focus on the idea that the birth is important. It's the next real opportunity for trauma. And we know parents will tell you the birth is better than the diagnosis. A lot of times we think the birth is the trauma or the baby is the trauma, which is why abortion is so routinely offered. But it's really the diagnosis is the trauma, and that parents who are well prepared can have wonderful births. Even if it means babies dying, they can have very peaceful births because they've anticipated what an end might look like and they've arranged for the things they need in that experience. And that was not something that they could do around the diagnosis itself.
And you've given them time to prepare too, and just to know that they've given everything to that child from the start. That's so good.
We have some family birth pictures, a lot of them actually, because really we end up welcoming these babies. You know, when we talk about service, these aren't clients, these are parents that we're serving. We're very focused on the pastoral aspects of this. But sometimes when I'm presenting, you know, so often people want to think that prenatal diagnosis, that the answer is misdiagnosis. Oh, there's a lot of misdiagnosis. Or, you know, sometimes babies are born and they don't have whatever was thought that they were going to have. And there's a little bit of truth in that. There's not a lot of misdiagnosis. But yeah, sometimes babies are a little different. They're generally not without some issue if an issue has been identified. So sometimes I'll show like one of our really great birth pictures with mom and dad and a two-year-old big brother and a baby with anencephaly is the one in particular that I like to share, baby Skylar. And I'll say to parents, you know, what happened between the diagnosis and the birth wasn't a miraculous cure, wasn't a misdiagnosis. What happened was the parents got ready for the reality of the baby that God had sent them, whatever that was. And there's often, I mean, anyone who's a parent knows there's tremendous uncertainty when you open up your heart to life. You know, maybe your baby's healthy, but at 7, they're diagnosed with cancer. Maybe that doesn't happen, but they're a terrible teenager. I mean, there's all kinds of things, uncertainty. So these parents have to deal with uncertainty, and that's difficult. But we can all prepare for uncertainty. And we all love the children. You know, God doesn't entrust an immortal soul to you without creating some bonding that's almost biologic, certainly psychological. So it's different when it's your baby. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that. That would be very beautiful. What would you say to, let's say, parents who just found out a prenatal diagnosis? What words of encouragement would you give them?
First, I would say, gosh, I'm so sorry this happened to you. Mm-hmm. And you really need to think about the fact that there's probably some trauma here and there's certainly grief. Mm-hmm. I think also that, you know, chances are obviously abortion's been offered. We probably don't know enough about your baby to have that have been a reasonable offer. So seek support for yourselves, because this is a path. And certainly for Catholic parents, there's the risk to the life, the dignity of the baby by abortion. Then there's the risk to the life of the baby, certain babies with certain diagnoses in terms of limitation of care at birth. And then I would say, you know, because this is about trauma and this is about grief, you know, if you lose your husband, people tell you, psychologists and counselors, people will tell you, don't make any major decisions in the first year, because it's so possible to make a bad decision for yourself. So like, don't clean out all of his stuff and sell the house, move away. You may regret that. So we really talk about slowing down. Oftentimes they leave the ultrasound and they have the induction of labor already scheduled at the hospital for 72 hours later. So we encourage them, slow down. You need to take some time to be first to heal, and then to think about what parenting looks like for you in this situation. And then I think also it's very important that parents understand that the medical community's perspective of the baby is different. And it always will be different, kind of because this family's only going to have one first child, one first baby girl, whatever. The doctor doesn't have that same level of connection. And that parents who carry to term never have regret. That's been proven in the medical research as well as in the our own surveys of parents. Parents who terminate oftentimes have regret. And oftentimes it's because, you know, these are the only women post-abortive who are handed a baby. These are usually abortions in the hospital setting where you may be having an induction, you deliver an infant, and oftentimes that baby doesn't look as scary as what you were led to believe, partially because that baby is yours, you know, and we know that. We know that, as I said, God doesn't send a baby to you to destroy you, but nor does he send a baby to you that you don't feel some attachment to. So those are probably the big first things that we would say.
Oh, so thank you, Tracy, so much for sharing all of this beautiful things that you do. Can you give us a little bit more about kind of where our audience can find what the process looks like of maybe if one of our members needs help, how they can find your work?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is benotafraid.net. And there's a parent referral form as well as a contact form there. We are still training organizations. So the Archdiocese of Philadelphia has taken our training and has a parent care coordinator, the Archdiocese of Newark, the Diocese of Fort Wayne, South Bend, and then a lot of organizations that aren't Catholic. So we're still looking for orgs to train. And we do respond to parents within about 24 hours of them leaving that parent referral form at our website.
Awesome. Perfect. And then do you refer them out to those people that you've trained, or you just discuss it? Okay, perfect.
They'll probably have an initial contact with me because I try to get a little bit more information before I make the referral. Mm-hmm. But then we refer them out to the services that we've trained, mm-hmm. and all of which are following Catholic teaching on this issue, because stabilize and evaluation is supported by the medicine, by the research, as well as being, you know, preferred by the church. Mm-hmm. Truth is truth.
Yes, that's true. No matter what. Yep. Thank you so much, Tracy, for being on the show today and sharing this beautiful work and your expertise in this field.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovshrine.org.